This is Fresh Air. Art Linson is a Hollywood producer. You may think he spends his time barking orders and making money hand over fist. Don't fool yourself, he says. He's always in the position of asking studios for money, asking agents for talent, even asking the director for permission to visit the set. Linson produced the films Car Wash, American Hot Wax, Melvin and Howard, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Scrooged, The Untouchables, Casualties of War, Singles, This Boy's Life, and The Point of No Return. For most of his films, he originated the idea and found the writer, director, and studio backing. His new memoir about the perils of producing movies in Hollywood is called A Pound of Flesh. I particularly enjoyed his story of producing The Untouchables. Here's how he developed the idea.
I was brought over to Paramount to produce and develop material for them. And one of the things that they owned was the television series The Untouchables. And my feeling about it was that this could make a great movie if we didn't try to make it the way the television series made it, but try to lift it to another level. And they said, we'd love to make a movie about The Untouchables. We have no interest particularly in lifting it to another level, but do whatever you want. And I thought one of the ways to achieve that would be to try to get a very stylish, high-quality writer who you wouldn't ordinarily think would do a television series, remake a television series, but could maybe lend something special to it. And one of the writers that I thought would be great for this was David Mamet, particularly because I knew he was from Chicago, and the folklore of Elliot Ness and Al Capone is sort of a mainstay in Chicago, and I thought he might be attracted to the subject matter, you know, notwithstanding the television series. So I set up a meeting with him, and I sat with him, and I was trying to figure out how I would convince him to do The Untouchables. And in the end, I just thought I'd just be straight and honest about it and said, listen, David, you don't know me, but I know you just won the Pulitzer Prize for writing the play Glengarry Glen Ross. Don't you think it would be great to just make a whole lot of money from Hollywood and write the screenplay to The Untouchables? And I thought, you know, like some people after winning the Pulitzer might say, oh my God, money, please, you know, check, please, can I get out of here? But he just sort of turned to me and he went, okay. And that was sort of the end of the meeting. He agreed right there to do it. He liked the idea, and he went ahead and wrote a screenplay which was substantially different from the television series. And he almost created like an, you know, sort of an operatic little tale of the teacher of Elliot Ness who sacrifices his life to try to go after Al Capone, and that's the character that Sean Connery made so famous. And that screenplay really sort of dictated the future of that movie. And what I mean by that is it ended up attracting Brian De Palma to direct it. It ended up attracting Kevin Costner, who, even though he wasn't a movie star at the time, was still very selective about what he wanted to do.
Now, let me stop you. Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
No, and of course it attracted Sean Connery and Robert De Niro. So the script was a very significant vehicle in determining what that movie ended up becoming.
Now, here's an interesting producer headache that you had. You had your screenwriter, David Mamet. You had your director, Brian De Palma. But De Palma decided that there were certain script changes that were needed. Mamet thought that he'd given you all the revisions that he was required to. He was working on directing his own movie, didn't have any time to do more revisions. And so explain.
Oh, he had David had the time. He didn't have the inclination.
Okay.
I mean, David writes too fast not to have the time. He could do it between, you know, courses at dinner. The fact is that, you know, David's a special case. He's a playwright who is extremely independent and has another career. He doesn't have to perhaps be as polite as other screenwriters in Hollywood have to be because, he can always go and write plays. So he was very difficult, and he wrote a sequence that took place on a series of crashing trains that when we tried to figure out how to do it in Chicago, it was, oh God, an extra $10 million to the budget. It was like preposterous with a series of train crashes and everything. And we had to restage some of the sequences in another way and had to have it rewritten. And Mamet would have none of it. And of course, you know, the producer's the one that has to march out and do the begging again. And I flew to Seattle to meet with David to say, which he said, I said, listen, David, I need some changes. I'd like to come out and talk to you about it. And he says, hey, get on a plane. Come and see me. I flew to Seattle and met him, and I said, so let's have a talk about the script. He goes, oh, the script. And gosh, I'm not really prepared to do anything about the script. I flew to Seattle for you to tell me you're not doing the rewrite. He goes, yeah, and you could tell that fat Italian director, I mean, I ain't doing no more work. So that's what David did. So I went back, and Brian and I were left with the shambles of having to sort of recreate some of the sequences, one of which turned out to be that step sequence that Brian came up with from brilliantly designed and created by Brian, which is the shootout on the steps that he sort of took from the Potemkin movie. And another is a sequence in the opera sequence where nobody speaks, but it's conveyed very clearly that Al Capone is connected to the murder.
Yeah, so, and in the book you explained that you had to do the new sequences without dialogue because no one can write that dialogue that matches Mamet's dialogue.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's why the opera sequence, people are whispering in people's ears, but you can't hear what they're saying.
Okay, let's get to the actors. Now, you wanted Robert De Niro and you wanted Sean Connery, and they wanted more money than your studio was willing to give them. So explain how they each managed to sign up anyways.
Well, Sean Connery wasn't in that case. He expected more money, and we offered him very little, but he saw this as a great vehicle for him, and he immediately agreed to do it, and he ended up winning an Academy Award for it. Mm-hmm. De Niro, on the other hand, wanted a lot of money, and Brian and I were desperate to get De Niro, the studio just wouldn't go for it. And about 4 weeks before we were ready to start shooting, they said, listen, you're going to have to make a decision. And we decided to hire Bob Hoskins instead of De Niro. But about 2 weeks to go before we were ready to start, Brian, you know, was very blue about it and said, look, we've got to get De Niro. And both of us felt very strongly, how often do you have a chance of getting Al Capone to be played by Bob De Niro? And we had the studio executives fly to Chicago. Our budget was going massively over, and they were coming there to say that if we don't cut down the budget, they're going to cancel the movie. And we had some news for them. And when they arrived, we had a general meeting, and they said, "You're going to have to cut the picture back, or we're not going to make it." And Brian said, "Well, I got to be honest with you right now. We're not only going to not cut it back. If you don't make it with Bob De Niro, we're not prepared to make the movie." So there was a brief impasse, and the result was that Bob Hoskins was removed from the picture. We paid him off, and we hired Bob at his salary. And the rest is, on the screen.
God, I can't imagine how many aspirins you must take during
during
the course of a
movie. Yeah, I got to say, I saw my career flash in front of my eyes
really?
On several occasions on that movie.
Yeah, yeah. You're just joining us. My guest is film producer Art Linson. He has a new memoir called A Pound of Flesh, Perilous Tales of How to Produce Movies in Hollywood. We're going to take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is movie producer Art Linson, and he has a new book about his adventures producing movies called A Pound of Flesh. I found your description of working with De Niro fascinating. You know, I've seen him on enough talk shows to know that De Niro off screen isn't at all like he is on screen. And when you first met him, you thought, this is an imposter. How can he possibly play those roles? This isn't him.
Well, one of the things that happened that, you know, is very amusing, actually, is that, you know, we went through it such a horrible time to get Bob to be in the picture. I mean, it required paying Bob Hoskins off completely.
Mm-hmm.
It expanded the budget. The studio was mad, but they had no alternative but to go forward because they had now spent so much money to get in that they needed to make the movie. After all that, I had yet to meet Bob. So finally the deal was done, and he flew into Chicago. We were about to make the picture, where he wanted to meet us, look at his wardrobe, and then go off to Italy to gain 25 pounds so he could be Capone. So he came in to meet everybody, and it was about 11, 12 o'clock at night, and we were at the hotel, and De Palma said, okay, he's here. Come on up. He wants to talk. So I come in the room, the two of them are there, and I see what purportedly was Bob De Niro, this kind of very small, self-effacing guy on the couch, very shy, dressed in absolute clothes that would keep him as, you know, he could walk into a 7-Eleven and be unrecognized. And he was very quiet and said, you know, I'd like to look at some of the wardrobe and, you know, I've got some thoughts about the script. And it was very, very quiet, very unassuming, looked like you could blow him over the feather. And it was a brief half-hour meeting, and I remember going back down to my hotel room and immediately calling De Palma up and going, my God, this guy is going to play Al Capone? I mean, he said, if you didn't, you know, I'd like to get some fingerprints on him to make sure it's De Niro. This guy isn't going to scare, you know, the birds away. And he goes, nope, it's Bob. He says, and he says, even when you see him do it, it won't look like much until you see the dailies, until you see him on screen, and then you'll get it. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened.
So even when he was performing, it didn't look right? Wasn't
No, it's special. It's special when he's performing. But I mean, it's even more spectacular when you see it blown up on the screen. I mean, he's just got a spectacular instinct for creating the kind of excitement that he does.
Well, let's go back to the aspirin bottle for a minute. After after you get De Niro and you're convinced, okay, it's really him after all, in spite of the fact that he's so meek-looking, he looks at the wardrobe and he decides he needs a completely different wardrobe than the wardrobe you have. You're already massively over budget. So what was wrong with the wardrobe that you had, and what did it cost to go along with his changes?
Well, actually, Bob is so polite that he really, I was just getting to know him. It was only the second day that we had spoken, and he doesn't really, you know, comment that directly. We went to the set, and he tried on all of the wardrobe, and then he called me in, and it's wardrobe that was designed by Armani. It was, you know, an enormous amount of money was spent on it. And it was spent, actually, with the thought that probably Bob Hoskins was going to be wearing it. And he tried everything on, and he asked if he could speak to me. And I said, sure. I came into his trailer, and he took me aside, and he goes, I said, so how's everything going? How do you like the wardrobe? And he goes, I like it. He goes, I said, did you try everything on? He goes, yeah. I tried every single piece on, which he did. It was hours. And I said, so how do you like it? He goes, I like it. I said, so let me get this straight. What you really want me to do is get rid of all of this wardrobe, throw it away, and you want to start over with somebody else. You hate it. He goes, exactly. And I said, okay, we'll do it. And that's exactly what we did. I mean, he never once said he didn't like it. I could just tell by the look on his face. He was miserable. And he ended up recreating, you know, Capone's wardrobe, actually with some of the authentic tailors that dressed Al Capone. I mean, he went to Sulca and got the robes that Capone used. And, I mean, he was, as usual, Bob was as exacting and as specific as anybody you can imagine. And as soon as I was willing to replace the wardrobe, we became great friends.
Were you happy with the movie?
I was. I mean, not with every aspect of it, quite honestly, but it was an excellent movie, yes.
Movie producer Art Linson is my guest. His new memoir is called A Pound of Flesh. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Producer Art Linson is my guest. Some of the movies he's produced include This Boy's Life, Point of No Return, Casualties of War, The Untouchables, Singles, We're No Angels, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Car Wash, and American Hot Wax. We were talking about The Untouchables, which Brian De Palma directed. Another movie that you did with him was Casualties of War. Now, this was a movie set in Vietnam during the war. Michael J. Fox was the lead. And this is a movie I like very much, and I like Michael J. Fox's performance in it very much. Nevertheless, I always wondered whether that was a selection that the studio asked for, or one that was already on your A-list. Because Michael J. Fox, at that time, was, I think, one of those real commercially bankable actors. And I know sometimes studios say, well, if you want to make the movie, you've got to choose from this list of big commercially bankable people.
Terry, you know more about Hollywood than I do.
Is this not true? Am I?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, okay. Look, the Casualties of War was another example of, by the way, a screenplay written by a playwright, David Rabe.
Mm-hmm.
The casting of Michael J. Fox was clearly a commercial choice that the studio wanted, and it was the kind of screenplay that without a piece of casting like that, we couldn't have gotten the money to make the film.
Mm-hmm.
So to take nothing away from Michael J. Fox, I knew early on as we were making the film that it was going to be hard for the public to want to see Michael in such a compromised, difficult situation. And And it was hard for them. It's not taking anything away from the performance that he did, because I thought he did a very, very good job. But there's no question that the audience has they want to see Michael funny. They don't. Michael in pain is not anything that they want to see. You know, so you know. But in fact, Michael and even in a helmet, I don't even think anybody wants to see. But I thought he did an admirable job. In fact, I think it's one of his best performances.
I agree with you. Let me ask you about testing, and this is the kind of testing where you show the movie or the movie in progress to an invited audience who then gets to answer a lot of questions about their reaction to the film. I've heard many people complain about this process. I've heard a few people defend it as actually very useful feedback to have. Do you find it useful?
It can be useful. In most cases it can be very destructive, but it can be useful. One of the tricks, look, the preview process for the filmmakers is one of the worst things anybody has to go through, because after 3 years of being on a movie and doing everything you can to make it as good as you can, suddenly you're sitting in front of 300 people in Sacramento who fill out cards, and then we have a focus group of the 20 of them, and they're suddenly telling the studios how they would like to see the ending changed. And the studios immediately respond to it, and serious results, usually negative, result from that process.
You're producing a movie. You're satisfied with say the ending's a little ambiguous or something, and you like it that way. You've just tested the movie, and the cards are coming back saying, nah, we wanted it to be happier. It would be better if it was happier. And the studio's saying to you, you really need to change this ending. It's too ambiguous. It's not going to work. Are you in any position to fight it? I mean, have you had to defend what you think is
well,
the truer
you have
ending?
A partnership here. I mean, mm-hmm. After all, somebody's just put up $20 million for your movie.
Right.
They've got, 15 kids in the front row saying, gosh, if Mary would only just drive away in the Chevy. And an executive is looking at that saying, well, what if they're right? I mean, my God, this one mistake may bury us. I mean, so it's a pressure situation. And frankly, it isn't a question of having the power as much as the ability to try to argue your case. You can't expect somebody who puts up that kind of money not to be afraid for their investment. They're mm-hmm. continually afraid for their mm-hmm. investment. And taking risks like putting up, like having an ambiguous ending or having a movie that needs violence and expresses itself in a violent way, or a whole variety of things that could be a little controversial, the preview process will immediately pick up as being controversial. And one of the worst previewed movies in the history of previews was Goodfellas, Martin Scorsese's movie. They couldn't get anybody to fill out a card to say they liked the movie because it was so violent. It was an enormously successful movie. I mean, one of his most successful movies he ever directed. And the guy that previewed the movie ultimately had to say, well, I called that wrong. We previewed it and it was wrong. They're wrong all of the time. I mean, it's remarkable how often they're wrong. And so that doesn't mean that if the preview process isn't useful, it means that it has to be used very cautiously, and then it can be useful.
Did you ever really take a bath on a film?
Me personally? Some studios have, sure. I mean, I'm glad you listed most of my hits, but I mean, yes. Yes, they've taken a couple of baths on some.
Does it shake your confidence when that happens?
Listen, my confidence is shaken, every week in Hollywood. So, yes, of course it shakes your confidence. You feel terrible about it. I just put out a movie called This Boy's Life, which I loved and
yeah.
thought it was, and still think it's a terrific movie. I mean, I couldn't pay people to walk across the street to see it if I offered to give them free parking and food. And it was just one of those pictures that could have and should have done better, but didn't. And the studio ended up losing money.
What are you working on now? What's your pet project now?
Well, I'm developing a couple of movies for Warner Brothers that I'm excited about. One is a movie called Catwalk, which is a romantic thriller that takes place in Paris. An American girl goes back to try to retrieve the dead body of her famous model sister, and she gets into sort of a charade-type movie, and hopefully that's going to start at the beginning of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just back after this book tour, back to doing what I've always had to do, which is develop material and beg people to make the movies.
Right. Well, thanks a lot for sharing with us some of what it is that you do, and I appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Terry.
Art Linson's new memoir about producing movies is called A Pound of Flesh.